This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
I went to Hurricanes practice for the first time. It's been more than 2.5 years. I'm sorry, 1.5 years, not 2.5 years. It was February, late February of 2020. It's the last time I went to a morning skate at PNC Arena.
Consume me!
There you go, Trip Tracy, who will join us during the season weekly here on this program, and he'll be all over the radio, with Alec in the pregame show for the Hurricanes, if you are a Hurricanes radio listener. So, because we started this show in the middle of 2020, we stopped going. Well, we didn't have any morning skates anymore because we were already in the throes of the pandemic. And when last year, I never went to a morning skate. Media weren't really allowed to interview. Everything was on Zoom, so we never went to one. So today, with the start of training camp, I got a chance to check out Team Attitude, which was the NHL group, pretty much. And Team Energy is off the ice. They have just practiced. They went at 11 o'clock. But I saw Team Attitude. I think you have to say it that way. And maybe Team Energy, you have to really pep it up. Team Energy. Team Attitude. So the NHL group practiced already today, and we have already instilled panic among the Hurricane fan base, Alec, because I noticed the lines, the forward lines, and Andrei Svechnikov was not skating with Sebastian Aho and Teuvo Teravainen. And everybody is terrified that they will never be reunited again.
I saw Svechnikov was skating on the third line.
Yes, he was skating on a third line with Jordan Staal and Jesper Fast.
Come on, people.
Oh, my gosh. The people are so angry.
We don't really believe that that's where Svech is going to skate.
They're
do we?
So angry about this. I love it. And because I will admit that I thought, well, this will be fun to tweet out because people will be upset. I'm not trying to make you upset. I just was getting my own juices flowing to cover the team this year.
You were trolling everybody.
Yeah.
You can be honest about it.
But I'm admitting that. Yeah. I was just getting my own juices flowing.
You were...
It's time, Hurricanes fans. It's time to engage. So do I believe that the Hurricanes will start and stay with Nino Niederreiter, Sebastian Aho, and Martin Natchez on the top line? Do I believe that? Well, Aho and Natchez is the thing. We saw that last year. Remember, Teravainen missed 75% of the season, and Aho and Natchez became a thing. Do I think Nino's playing with them? Nah, not really. I could see Jesperi Kotkaniemi there. But anyway, Kotkaniemi was on a line with Vincent Trocheck and Teuvo Teravainen. And then it was Svechnikov, Staal, and Jesper Fast. And a couple things about this. One, come on, we know Rod Brind'Amour. Rod Brind'Amour, he loves Jordan Staal. He looks at Jordan Staal and says, gigantic human being, has the puck a lot. So if he has the puck and Svechnikov is skating with him, Andre will get the puck and Andre will score. Beginning of the year, when they were playing together, Andre was, scoring a lot. Maybe one has to do with the other. And the other thing is that Rod always likes to spread his lines out anyway, spread his star offensive players out, rather than concentrate them on one line. But ultimately, you know what's going to happen? Svechnikov is going to be back with Aho and Teravainen. So stop worrying about it. But it was fun to be out there. I had one pang of regret, Alec. I got to the arena about 8:30 today. Practice did not begin until 9. Svechnikov was the first skater out. Not a surprise. He's always the first skater out. So anyway, I got there about 8:30. And I walk in, and the media sits in the sections behind the Hurricanes bench for practices. So I walk down, and that's when it hit me that our friend John Forslund's not there. Now, I know how people are going to interpret this. I am not talking at all about the broadcast. Mike Maniscalco does a good job. This is not about Mike. This is about, for as long as I've been covering the team on a regular, steady, concentrated basis. But before then, too, since I have been covering the team, every single time I have gone to a morning skate and I have walked down the aisle, other than those moments where Forslund is off doing an NBC game, John Forslund has been there. And John is one of my absolute rock sources of hockey knowledge and fun at these events. So it hit me today that that's over. John didn't do the games last year, but I never went to a morning skate. So I didn't have to experience that. And it bugged me today. Now, again, I was talking to Maniscalco during the practice. This is not about Mike. This is about my friend John is 2,500 miles away. So we might have to call him just to reminisce. I don't know. Not today. Maybe tomorrow, maybe Monday, whenever. Hurricanes preseason starts Tuesday at home against the Tampa Bay Lightning. So, but I was not the only one who felt that way. Chip Alexander, News and Observer. Luke DeCock, News and Observer. Unsolicited, said exactly the same thing when they walked in. Chip was already there. When I walked in, and I'm thinking all these things, walking down the aisle, and I said hi to Chip, and I said, how you been? He goes, been good. Miss Forslund. Like, wow, I'm not the only one who feels that way. So that was, in a way, comforting. Man, we got a bunch of stuff to do. I got my Ryder Cup stat of the day. Do we have time to do the Ryder Cup stat of the day?
You want a stat?
All right, then we'll start this old shenanigan. Whatever I'm trying to say. I'm very excited today, Alec. I don't know. Thursday, man, is a lot going on.
You've been chatty today.
I have been chatty today. I tell you, I felt really good. It felt like home getting back inside PNC Arena for Hurricanes practice.
Did you sleep well last night?
I slept great.
Oh, so you... Did you have your high score, sleep score last night?
I don't keep score.
Okay.
I'm like Ty Webb when it comes to when it comes to sleeping.
Now,
how do
you
keep
measure
score?
Yourself with other sleepers?
By height.
Okay. Don't sell yourself short.
You're a tremendous slouch. All right, so here's my Ryder Cup stat of the day. Last team session is the setup to singles. Yesterday's stat of the day was about singles, right? So the last team session is the setup. How do you finish the team matches? Do you carry that momentum to the dozen match-deciding singles competition, or do you squander a lead? Here's an example of what separated the United States from a win and maybe a romp at Medina in 2012. U.S. is up 10-4 with two matches on the course in four ball, right? Afternoon four ball. They're up 10-4. They lead, and so two matches are on the course. Luke Donald with opponent Tiger Woods about 5 feet away for birdie on the par 3 17th, stuffed his tee shot into kick-in range, maybe 2 feet, maybe, probably not even. And he and Sergio Garcia went on to beat Woods and Steve Stricker one up. Now it's 10-5. That was a great undercard. Ian Poulter birdied the final five holes to carry Rory McIlroy to a one-up win over Zach Johnson and Jason Duffner. Poulter was berserk. He was a man possessed. McIlroy's reaction to that was just laughter. So the United States was this close to 11-5 or 12-4 ahead. It's over if it's that. Instead, it's 10-6. David Faraday actually called it a 10-6 tie. And Europe went on to channel the ghost of the late Seve Ballesteros in a miracle comeback win the next day. In the last 12 events, here's the stat, Alec. The United States has won the final team session just 3 times. Remember, we talked about the U.S. hasn't had any trouble starting well the first session? The last team session has been a problem. So, run through the tape. That's all I'm saying. Run through the tape. Europe is 5-3-4 in the last team session of the first 2 days of the Ryder Cup. Run through the tape. All right, let's start, Alec. Potentially the shortest out of the gate we've ever done. Game night, we have 2 game nights. Second game will come your way in a couple of seconds here. Panthers in Houston for a meeting with what's left of the Texans. They stuck it to Urban Meyer and the Jaguars in week one. Actually had a first half 14-7 lead in Cleveland last week. But then Tyrod Taylor got hurt. Davis Mills came on and woof. Bad. And it will be Mills running the Houston offense tonight. Taylor has a hamstring strain, but you can relax, if you will, at your own peril. Here's Doug Kazarian from ESPN's Daily Wager show on wagering the Panthers and Texans.
Welcome to the Daily Wager studios here on the Las Vegas Strip. I'm Doug Kazarian alongside Tyler Foljam and Joe Fortenball. So not exactly household power blue blood teams on this Thursday night matchup, but I like Houston plus the points. I like what Carolina's done, but let's face it, they've played both games at home, one against the Jets and a rookie QB making a debut, and the other one against a Saints team that was kind of in disarray, a bunch of coaches out with COVID, and they're always moving, not playing at home. On top of that, there is a trend on a short week when you have a quarterback making his first career start. How about 5-0 against the spread? Basically, there's just an overreaction in the market. I'll grab all the points with the home dog.
Interesting. I like that. I'm going to play the total in this one. We'll go under 43 points. I think Carolina's defense is legit. Legit to the point that people didn't realize before the season started. Number one in the NFL in opponent yards per play. Number one in the NFL in third down conversions. Number one in the NFL in scoring defense. Sure, some of it was against Zach Wilson. The other game was against Jameis Winston and the Saints, who blew up the Green Bay Packers. I'm going to play under 43.
I like the Panther side, but I'm going to isolate a prop because I think this is the way they get to that victory, and it's riding Christian McCaffrey.
Yes.
Duh. Over 136.5 rushing and receiving yards for CMC, who's averaging 29.5 touches per game and 162 offensive yards per game. So as a touchdown-plus favorite against the bad team, CMC should have a big game.
He should really really light up that defense. I'm just excited to see Matt Rhule punt from Houston's 33-yard line.
2-0, Douglas.
I'm sorry, that last one got me. Matt Rhule, I'm just excited to see Matt Rhule punt from the plus 33. Find the line.
I'm just glad we're not the only ones.
Fine.
I'm just glad. Why is Doug got to take a shot at the non-blue blood thing at the beginning?
You know what?
We know that.
He's
we
not
know.
Right. He's not wrong, but you're right. That was gratuitous, but he brought it home.
He did.
With
I
Matt Rhule punting.
I appreciated that.
Real quick before we get to the other football game. Sam Darnold today. Tonight. Avoid the big mistake. Texans forced a couple of turnovers.
They got a decent defense.
Right? They have a decent defense. Don't make the big mistake because that's how you – I mean, again, I've said this before. I won't be shocked. They shouldn't lose to the Texans, but I won't be shocked. It's the National Football League. The worst teams in the league are going to win a handful of games, and they're likely all going to be at home. And the Panthers are not one of the elites. Forget about Blue Bloods. They're not one of the elite teams. And if you are not, you can lose to anyone. So, here's the mantra. What have we been saying? Sam, be tofu. Be
yes.
Quinoa.
Be quinoa.
Just do it, man. Let everybody else do the work.
Be boring, but pack a punch.
Exactly. High protein grains. That's what we need. In 1947, Jackie Robinson was the first black player in the history of Major League Baseball, at least as far as history tells us. But it actually happened in another sport the year before. Integration came to the NFL the year before, and it's written about in the book The Forgotten First. Bob Glauber, longtime NFL writer for Newsday in New York, along with Keyshawn Johnson. We're going to talk to Bob Glauber here, but my first question is, you spent a lot of time with Keyshawn. Why was this book important to him?
That's a good question, and it really did turn out to be important to him. We started talking about this a year ago over the summer, and this is something I'd been thinking about for a while. It's just not a lot written about the integration and really the reintegration of the NFL, and this was a reintegration.
Right.
And I talked to Keyshawn. I've known him for 25 years since he first started with the Jets. And I said, I got an idea. See what you think. And I told him, I said, all right, who's the first black baseball player in modern major league history? Jackie Robinson. Well, who's the first black football player in modern NFL history? And he says, I know this. Kenny Washington, mm-hmm. Woody Strode, and he said, wow. And we were both like flabbergasted at how little is known about such an important milestone in NFL history. And it became, we decided within 2 minutes of our conversation that, we got to do this. And it really became a labor of love. Writing about these guys, writing about the situation facing the NFL back in the 40s when there were no black players.
Mm-hmm.
For 12 years, there was basically a ban on black players in the NFL. And these, Woody Strode and Kenny Washington with the Rams, and then Bill Willis and Marion Motley signed with the Cleveland Browns, who were with the All-America Football Conference at that time and eventually turned into the NFL. And it's a really important time in sports history that, everybody knows Jackie Robinson, and really nobody knows these guys.
And
so,
we're
happy to present it.
Bob Glauber is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. And the interesting thing about this is that Washington, and I think Strode also, were college teammates of Jackie Robinson at UCLA.
Yeah, that's correct. They were on the same football team, on the same offense as Jackie Robinson. There was a 1939 football team. I never knew this stuff. But in 1939, UCLA had an unbeaten season, first in school history. They came close to winning a national championship. Kenny Washington was the star of that team. And Jackie had transferred from Pasadena Junior College, a lot of schools after him, and he decided on UCLA. He joined these guys for just an epic football season. And they came close to beating – they tied USC in the final game of the season to determine basically the chance to win the national title, the Rose Bowl. And it was a 0-0 tie. And back in those days, that was – that's an epic game. And 103,000 people at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum attended that game, and all of them stood and roared for Kenny Washington because it was his last college football game. A lot of interesting stuff back then.
Really speaks to the difference between football and baseball at that time and in our nation's history. Because if it were flipped, we would all be talking about Washington and Strode and Motley and Willis, probably about Jackie Robinson as well. But it would be flipped. We'd all know who these guys were. At the very least, from your position at New York Newsday, if I could flip it to modern quarterbacks, so you were in a great spot to watch Sam Darnold for 3 years, and now here in Carolina, we have seen. And I grew up a Jets fan, so I'm well aware of what Sam Darnold had to go through. I call myself a recovering Jets fan. Darnold to me had zero chance to succeed in New York, and now I think we are seeing that with at least some help, and he's definitely getting some, that he certainly looks like a competent quarterback that you can win with. How much of what Darnold dealt with in New York was Jets-related? How much of it was Darnold-related?
I would say it was a combination of the two, probably a little bit more Jets-related, because unfortunately for Darnold, he was caught in between two regimes, coaching and general manager. It's just a deadly combination. He was drafted by Mike Maccagnan, played for Todd Bowles the first year. Bowles is fired. And then Adam Gase begins the first of a two-year nightmare as head coach, and Joe Douglas replaces Mike Maccagnan as general manager. So you have the two key positions in terms of managing a football team that are different, you know, in Sam during Sam Darnold's time. He handled it like a pro. He did as well as he could. He got bad coaching from Adam Gase. He got inferior team building from Mike Maccagnan and, you know, partly from Joe Douglas. Joe Douglas still an incomplete grade on his team building. But and it all added up to, you know, a witch's brew of problems. And I'm glad for Sam. I was at that game in Carolina when he beat the Jets. And, you know, good for Sam. He's a pro's pro. And he's handled it like a champ. And good for him that he's getting help that he needs.
Yeah, and it certainly is nice when Christian McCaffrey lines up in the backfield with you and you can give it to him 30 times a game. It's very simple to talk about Ezekiel Elliott and some of the other running backs in the league. Is there a better player at the position than Christian McCaffrey?
I don't think so. And I think you have to look at Christian McCaffrey's running and receiving ability. And that's what makes him so special. I mean, you know, he is a quarterback's best friend. Hand the ball to him, he's going to gain 8 yards minimum. Swing pass to him when you're in trouble, he's going to gain 8-10 yards and maybe turn it into a touchdown or turn it into 20 yards, whatever. He's just so productive and he's so runs downhill and plays downhill. It's immeasurable. You know, if Sam Darnold had a guy like that in New York and he had a good offensive line, I think he'd still probably be here, and the Jets wouldn't be picking second overall and taking Zach Wilson. So, you know, it's a lot of woulda, shoulda, coulda. But Darnold, to his credit, has never blamed anybody but himself. And he's really, I mean, he deserves this as much as anybody.
Bob Glauber of New York Newsday, also the author of The Forgotten First. He wrote it with Keyshawn Johnson about the players that reintegrated the National Football League in the mid-1940s. Before I ask you about the game of the week, which is Tampa going to the LA Rams, I have a working theory, and I'm just curious your thoughts on it. And I'm not, feel free to completely disagree with me, but I think over the the last 10, maybe 15 years, the National Football League has been doing this. They have been overdrafting quarterbacks. They have been rushing them to the field, and then they have been way too soon getting rid of them. Is that fair or an unfair statement?
Actually, I think it's a pretty fair statement. And look, the need for quarterbacking has never been greater in a league that is absolutely passing-centric. So you're going to, what you say, overdraft. And there's just no question about it. That's been going on for a long time. And a lot of times those quarterbacks don't work out. You know, most of the time they won't work out. And you even saw it in the class of 83, probably the best quarterback class of all.
Yep.
I mean, Todd Blackledge was a part of that class. Tony Eason, he got to a Super Bowl. And Ken O'Brien. But, you know, you don't think of them when you think of Marino, Kelly, and Elway.
Yeah.
So it's a crapshoot in a lot of ways. I will say this, though. With very few exceptions, I know you're trotting these guys out early and you're seeing sooner rather than later if they can play. But if you make a decision on them, it's generally correct. Now Darnold is a potential exception here, as is Ryan Tannehill.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they had some successes, but some failures where they were the first, you know, teams, and then they moved on and they did very well. Tannehill doing great in Tennessee with a great running back, and Sam doing great in Carolina with a great running back. They also have the similarity that they played for Adam Gase. So, you know, when you get away from Adam Gase, you're ahead of the game.
Yep. Everybody should try to get away from Adam Gase. I'm not talking about his personal situation. I'm sure he's a wonderful guy away from the football facility. Here's the thing about it is that there's so many factors. I just wish that we wouldn't give up on these players. I also wish – I know Andrew Brandt, who writes for Monday Morning Quarterback and has an incredible resume when it comes to being in football, thinks that all of these guys should be on the field in year one. And I just think that you can do so much more damage to these players than you can help them I wouldn't play any of these guys until they were ready. I think there's a reason why Patrick Mahomes is the best, arguably the best quarterback in football. And it's because he's gotten incredible coaching, and he was allowed to watch for 15 of his first 16 games.
Yeah, that's a fair point. However, I will say this. You know, they drafted Patrick Mahomes at the perfect time because Alex Smith was still a playoff quarterback mm-hmm. and a functional, very functional quarterback and one of the great pros in the game. So Patrick Mahomes was able to watch Alex Smith prepare. He saw how he worked for Andy Reid, and it was a completely perfect apprenticeship. Now, Kyler Murray, though, I mean, I think it was smart to play him right away. He's developing in now in year three. Russell Wilson played right away. I think it's different for different quarterbacks.
Right.
Maybe Darnold, you know, would have benefited. And you go back further. It's a salary cap era and free agency. That's the problem, and that's the pressure of having to start these guys early because you've got to make decisions before their first contracts are over. You know, Phil Simms was one of the great quarterbacks for the New York Giants. He was drafted in the first round in 1979. And you know when he got good? In 1984.
Right.
That would never happen today. He'd be gone.
He would be. There's no question about it. All right, final thing, last minute with Bob Glauber, author of The Forgotten First, about reintegrating the NFL. Tom Brady and the Buccaneers are at Matthew Stafford and the Rams. Like, I hate to play the preview of what's happening in early February, but I think the Rams have been impressive.
They really have been impressive. And, you know, Matthew Stafford is kind of everything you want in that big quarterback that Sean McVay loves to have. Big arm, can make all the throws, more of a bold quarterback than Jared Goff. And that's the quarterback that McVay can win with. And it's an epic matchup. It's a great early season matchup. I kind of like the Rams in this one. I think home field makes a big difference in this. And I think Aaron Donald probably makes a bigger difference. You know, there's one guy who can get to Brady up the middle. And that's been his kryptonite over the years. You know, if you can get to him up the middle, then you have a chance.
Yeah, I'm a huge Aaron Donald fan. I appreciate your time, Bob Glauber. You follow him on Twitter at Bob Glauber. He makes it easy. The Forgotten First with Keyshawn Johnson about reintegrating the National Football League. Great luck with the book. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Bob Rotella is a renowned sports psychologist and is the author of many a book on golf. The latest is Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot. I have read Golf is Not a Game of Perfect, which is a few years back, and he joins us on the Adam Gold Show. Thank you very much for your time. You have timed this beautifully. The book came out two days ago. So I hope it's already a New York Times bestseller. So let me ask you about the way you prepare, and we're going to get into specifically what your book is about, though, but I need to know the way you prepare for something like this psychologically, the Ryder Cup, as opposed to a regular PGA Tour event.
Well, I think the number one thing is getting every player on the team to buy into the team concept. And, you know, what I talk about with the captains and the coaches all the time over the years and this year with the Ryder Cup is you have to get players who spent their whole life being individual athletes to now become a team sport athlete. And the difficulty is you don't always get the dream role on the team that you always wanted. And so you have to get them to star in whatever role they're given. And what I mean by that is I don't want them to just accept the role they're given. I want them to star in it, which means I want you to do this role better than anyone's ever done it, and I want you to be the all-time best at it and believe that whatever role it is, it's really important to the team's success. And the player has to not only get himself to buy into it, but he has to get his spouse, his girlfriend, his mom, his dad, all of his friends that are emailing him, texting him to buy into the same thing and realize the only thing that matters is the team winning. The fact that they keep individual stats and records probably plays a role. The fact that they're individual athletes their whole life plays a role. And I think that's the main responsibility of the captains and the assistant captains and all the people that work with the team is to get people to buy into that. And hopefully, you know, certainly the players you pick, you know, you've really interviewed them and talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have players that have earned a spot on the team. And if you can get everyone to buy in, then you got a good chance.
Dr. Bob Rotella is joining us. The book is called Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot. How can, like, the average, you know, I'm a like a 13 handicap. How can the average golfer apply some of these principles to help them out?
Well, first thing I tell people is you can always think as good as a tour player. It's just that your ball isn't going to go where you're looking as frequently as a tour player. So, you know, that's the first thing you tell them. Because I think a lot of people want to use, I don't practice as much, I'm not as talented, I'm not as skilled, as a reason for thinking poorly. I go, well, that makes no sense. Just because you're not physically as skilled doesn't mean you don't want to think like them. And basically, you know, we'll give an example like the first tee shot at the Ryder Cup each day with crowd going crazy. It's like you have to have your eyes and your mind locked in to where you want the ball to go, kind of like a horse with blinders on or laser vision. But the whole point is we don't want anything in your mind other than seeing where you want the ball to go. And that means you can't be thinking about where you don't want to go or how bad it would be if I don't hit a good shot. I mean, it's just got to be seeing the shot you want and letting a swing happen. And what happens is your body on that first tee is filled with butterflies and excitement. And the best players learn the more nervous or excited your body is, the more you don't think. I think other people get nervous and they get worried about why am I feeling this way? I mean, we tell pro athletes the reason you're feeling that way is because you're in the Ryder Cup. And this is what we anticipated you were going to feel like. So if you went back further, they do a lot of visualization. They do a lot of mental rehearsal of what they're going to feel like, what the crowd's going to be like. So that it's like a deja vu experience by the time they get there. And they all have a mental process that they go through. Very similar, like I work with a lot of NFL kickers and college kickers and a lot of basketball players. And, I mean, if you look at an NFL kicker, they've got a routine and a process they go through, and it doesn't matter if it's a kick early in the game or late in the game, this is their process. And the same thing with a good free throw shooter. You know, they're going to really – they're just doing the routine. They're not worrying about whether it goes in or not. They're assuming it's going in, but they're going to do their routine. And part of it is because it gives you your best chance of hitting a good shot. And the other part of it is because you can live with it if it doesn't, if you did everything you planned on doing.
Dr. Bob Rotella is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. Ryder Cup starts in, oh my gosh, it's we're talking about like 16 hours. Make your next shot your best shot. I'm just going to ask you some questions about players. Do the best you can with how terrible these questions are. What allows a Sergio Garcia, who is not close to the player of a Tiger Woods, what allows a Sergio Garcia to be a significantly better Ryder Cup player than Tiger Woods?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, having worked with players on both teams for years, I would say both teams want it badly. They definitely, all the players want to win and want to play good. But the European kids grow up dreaming of beating American kids in golf. Probably American kids grow up dreaming about being European kids in soccer or cycling, you know, or rugby mm-hmm. or something. But in golf, the European kids, it's a huge feather in their cap. And for them, it's like bigger than almost anything else they play in. And it's a really, you know, it plays a role. I think the other thing is, you know, Sergio, I think, is feeding off Seve Ballesteros. I mean, who was really the European player that turned around the Ryder Cup
yep.
for Europe. I mean, prior to Seve, it wasn't much of a competition. And Seve just really got into it and really decided this would be a huge feather in the cap and fell in love with it. And I think, you know, Sergio, I mean, Elazabal came after him, and I think Sergio and now Rahm. You know, for some reason, the Spanish kids have really become leaders
yep.
on the Ryder Cup teams. I think the other thing I'd say is, let's not forget that Sergio was a child prodigy much like Tiger. I mean, Sergio, obviously Tiger's won a lot more than Sergio, but they both won a lot. But Sergio's a much better ball striker. And if you look at the Ryder Cup, Tiger and Phil, who didn't drive it that straight, they weren't as good in the Ryder Cup.
They were not.
And Sergio, who's a great ball striker, has done really, really well in the Ryder Cups.
Yeah, he's.
But I think you hit the nail on the head. It's more that there's just a motivation there that brings the European guys together. I think the other thing they have going, not just with Sergio, but with their team over the years, is they can pair two guys from England together. They can pair two guys from Spain together. They can, they can go by country and put guys together by nationality, which really brings them together. We don't quite have that. We're all Americans,
Yeah, we're going to have two guys from California together, it appears, in Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele. Final thing for Dr. Bob Rattell, and again, the book is Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot. Also, he's got several books on golf, and I have read Golf is Not a Game of Perfect, which is there is no more perfect title for a book about golf than that, because if we're lucky, even as decent players, if we hit two really great shots around, that's probably been a pretty successful day. But I am curious about this because there are a lot of people that put a lot of intangibles behind the success or lack thereof for the United States in a Ryder Cup. Over-preparation, strategy and things like that, where I really think, personally, while some of those things matter, I think the pressure of expectations has worked against the United States for most of the last two decades. Am I oversimplifying it? And are there so many other outside factors that have worked against U.S. teams in the past? Or am I right that it really is, it's tougher to win when you are expected to win?
I think you're right again. I think most people on the team over the years would agree that America is always labeled, they're supposed to win. And Europe, no matter how many times they beat us, what's been 9 of the last 12 times,
yep,
and they're always labeled the underdog. And I'll be the first to admit, I'm telling everyone, I think the U.S. could win by a lot this year, and Europe maybe could squeak out a win. But I could see the U.S. winning by a lot this year.
Mm-hmm.
But pressure becomes a big deal. So a lot of what the captains and assistant captains are doing, they're doing everything they can to just get the guys to relax and just play. The idea that Americans don't want to win badly enough is certainly a misnomer, but they sometimes put too much pressure on themselves. And where it really shows up is on the putting green.
Yeah,
ultimately, these things are won on the putting green. And you got to make some putts at the right moment. And that's where it's really important to be relaxed and at ease and just playing golf. And is it hard to just play golf when you're playing for the country and you're used to playing for yourself and you're playing for your teammates or playing for the captain? And you have to be able to get on the golf course and just play.
Dr. Bob Rattella, Make Your Next Shot Your Best Shot, the new one. It came out Tuesday. I hope it's a rip-roaring success, and I appreciate your time.
Hey, good talking to you, Adam. Take care.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.